Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Borisage of the Campaign for America's Future, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's proposed Wall Street rescue plan and why taxpayers should demand strict conditions be attached to any bailout funds. Climate activist and author Bill McKibben, who discusses the future of the movement to slow climate change and what's at stake on the issue in this year's U.S. presidential election. And author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind, who discusses his recently published book, The Way of the World, which reveals new evidence of Bush administration deceptions on justifications for the Iraq War. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The aid group CARE International is pushing the global community to prioritize fighting endemic poverty rather than deal with a succession of crises. During a drought emergency 3 years ago in the African nation of Niger, $80 were spent to save a malnourished child's life. Yet prior to the crisis, the same intervention only cost $1 per child. The CARE report, titled Living on the Edge, coincides with the opening of the United Nations General Assembly in New York, which will focus on the progress of the Millennium Development Goals designed to cut extreme poverty in half by 2015. In opening the session, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged the rich nations to spend $72 billion a year in Africa to fight poverty. CARE insists emergency aid released during humanitarian crises often arrives too late, is too short-term, and ignores long-term development needs in building up local political and economic initiatives. The International Aid Group cited cases where wealthy donor countries rejected funding projects in Africa to benefit vulnerable groups. Yet only months later, the same governments funded emergency response efforts that were far more costly after hunger grew to epidemic proportions. So far, in 2008, the World Food Program reports 75 million more people suffer from acute hunger, pushing the total number of hungry to over a billion. After months of turmoil, Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai signed a power-sharing agreement, leaving Mugabe as president and making Tsvangirai, head of the Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, prime minister. The deal, which splits power in the cabinet between Mugabe, Tsvangirai, and a small opposition faction, left control of the security services unresolved. Pressure is also building to investigate the human rights abuses against the MDC since the March 29th election, where Tsvangirai won a plurality of votes. Over 150 opposition leaders were killed, and thousands have been beaten in recent months, according to Human Rights Watch. So far, Western governments have welcomed the power-sharing deal, but remain cautious and have yet to commit economic aid to the new Zimbabwean government. The MDC had laid out an economic recovery strategy that relies on attracting foreign investment and aims to restart agriculture and other industries, which are only running at 25% to 30% of capacity. Zimbabwe owes $127 million to the International Monetary Fund. Prime Minister Tsvangirai told the Los Angeles Times there will be no prosecution of Robert Mugabe for past abuses. Human Rights Watch has called for an independent inquiry of the abuses during the Mugabe era. As Zimbabwe political observer John Makumbe told the Interpress Service, I view this deal as an egg. The contents are very good stuff, but the shell is very fragile and can be easily broken. Nearly 15 years after efforts were initiated to save the endangered spotted owl, the bird's numbers have continued to decline at an alarming rate in Oregon, Washington State, and Northern California. The falling population of the northern spotted owl is blamed by government scientists on the resurgence of the rival barn owl and the clear-cutting of old-growth forests. A new report released in July by the U.S. Geological Survey concluded the spotted owl, especially in Washington State, had reached a population bottleneck. The number of spotted owls has fallen so low, and owls are so genetically similar, that they may start inbreeding. The shrinking number of spotted owls in the Pacific Northwest has been used as a justification by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reopen 1.6 million acres of public forest to timber logging that had been previously off-limits due to the presence of the spotted owl. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In response to the panic on Wall Street following the failure and government takeover of major U.S. investment banks and the world's largest insurer, the Bush administration has proposed a $700 billion bailout of the U.S. financial system. But Congress has greeted the White House bailout legislation with skepticism. The bill would give Bush Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson the power to hand over nearly $1 trillion in taxpayer money to financial institutions to buy their distressed subprime mortgage-related assets. The money in the bailout bill amounts to $2,000 for every man, woman, and child in America, and specifically prevents any court of law or administrative agency from reviewing decisions made by the Treasury Secretary. Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd, chair of the Senate Banking Committee, rejected the White House plan and instead proposed the establishment of a board to oversee the allocation of bailout funds, place caps on executive salaries at institutions receiving help, and provide assistance for struggling homeowners. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has proposed that a 10% surtax be levied on those making over $500,000 a year, in order to raise an estimated $300 billion to fund the bailout. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Borisage, co-director of Campaign for America's Future, who explains why taxpayers should demand strict conditions, including new regulations and accountability, be imposed as part of any bailout plan.
Well, the plan presented by Secretary Paulson is shocking and alarming. This is a plan that essentially says the Secretary will be given $700 billion to spend on any financial institution that he designates for any asset that he chooses at any price that he may find reasonable, with no review by any court of law or external body. It is a staggering, anti-democratic, inconceivable plan. I mean, the audaciousness that would lead you to present something like that to the Congress is really just sort of unspeakable. And the notion that this administration, the most spectacularly corrupt administration in our history, would be given $700 billion to spend as they will is sort of frightening. So the Congress is now faced with this problem. On the one hand, you have the banking community saying, if you don't bail us out, we're going to bring down the entire world economy. And on the other hand, you have the administration saying this bailout has to go forward in the next 2 days, and it needs to be simple, and it needs to be clear, and it needs to follow our plan. So the Congress is now wrestling with this. Senator Dodd has put forward an alternative bill that makes that has some sense. It has an independent board for oversight. It says that if we're going to bail out some of these financial institutions, we're going to take an ownership position in them so that if they are successful and they profit, the taxpayers get repaid. It says that if you're going to bail out Wall Street, you've got to help Main Street as well, and takes steps on renegotiating mortgages and helping people stay in their homes. Speaker Pelosi has said that we're not going to do this unless we have a stimulus plan of some kind, which will help benefit the real economy and put people back to work. So Democrats are starting to discuss at least elements of an alternative plan that makes more sense. Whether they have the courage to stand up to the administration and stand up to what will likely be a stock market that suddenly craters when they decide that the Congress isn't going along with the administration remains to be seen.
You've just written an article where you detail some of the conditions that you think should be tied with any bailout plan for these financial institutions that gives the taxpayers some advantages here in terms of future regulations as well as some payback later on down the road when things stabilize.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of common sense, right, that if we're going to do this, which is an extraordinary, staggering sum of money, we've got to have some rules that apply. One of those is that we've got to have an independent board that's governing this, that it's not simply an insider deal with the Paulson, who comes from Goldman Sachs, dealing with his former colleagues on Wall Street. Secondly, taxpayers have to get their interests protected. They've got to take equity in any firm that decides to partake of the, to lay off their bad paper on us. And any firm that does that has got to be regulated and brought under severe investigation and regulation. Third, you've got to curb the casino on Wall Street, and you've got to extend regulations to companies that have, to the shadow banking system that's grown up really without it. You've got to get the real economy growing so that prosperity comes from the bottom up. You've got to help homeowners who made the same bad bet that the bankers made. You can't simply leave them in the cold. And they should be part of this process. And what would be nice is if you then had limits on executive compensation so that the executives who drove their companies into the ditch don't walk away with multi-million dollar compensation plans while leaving us with their bad debts. And then finally, to do any of this, my own sense is that Congress, if we, in an ideal world, would simply forswear any contributions from Wall Street PACs and executives, and we'd ban Wall Street lobbyists from the Beltway.
In your article, Shock Doctrine, Will We Get Fleeced in This Crisis, you talk about, as you just did now, the issue of lobbyist money tainting the process that Democrats, as well as Republicans, can very easily be bought off in this crisis here and really sell out the best interests of the American people. What's the counterbalance to that? Do you think enough people could get mobilized in this country to make sure that we don't get sold out in the next few days?
Well, that's our only hope. Our only hope is that everybody starts to get in touch with their legislator and tells them that they don't want Wall Street simply to get a blank check, and makes it clear that they're watching what's happening. This could be the largest bath that American taxpayers have ever taken unless we find some way of making it clear that we've got people in our sights and we're not going to let them get away with simply fleecing us.
That was Robert Borisaj, co-director of Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign at area code 202-955-5665. Read Borisaj's article, Shock Doctrine, Will We Get Fleeced in This Crisis?, online at ourfuture.org. The interest and concern generated by global climate change last year, when Al Gore and scientists on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and when grassroots activity erupted across the country, especially among young people, seems to have now been eclipsed by concerns about the economy. The current financial crisis has driven much of the news coverage about the climate crisis off the pages of newspapers and off the airwaves. But many people are still working hard to push for action to reduce greenhouse gases, which environmental scientists consider as much of a crisis, albeit a slow-motion one, as the financial meltdown. Bill McKibben is the author of The End of Nature, the first book on global warming, written in 1989 for a popular audience. McKibben has written several other books on climate change since then, and in recent years has become an activist and organizer. In 2007, he and six students from Vermont's Middlebury College, where he is a scholar in residence, organized 1,400 local actions as part of Step It Up, which called on politicians to reduce carbon emissions 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with McKibben about the future of the movement to slow climate change and what's at stake in this year's U.S. presidential election.
This presidential election, without any question, is the most important one of the global warming era. It's the last chance, from what the scientists are now telling us, that we're going to have to make any real policy shifts that stand much chance of affecting the long-term outcome. As Rajendra Pachauri, the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the Indian scientist who accepted the Nobel along with Al Gore last year, as he said recently, if we haven't made fundamental changes by 2012 in the way that we're using carbon around the world, if we haven't made fundamental moves away from coal and gas and oil, then the physical momentum of this problem will just be so large that we won't ever be able to get a handle on it. Which means, since 2012 is our next election, that this is the last president who really has a shot at that. It looked like it might be a real conversation about global warming at the beginning, because John McCain, more than most Republicans, has done reasonable work on this subject in the past. Unfortunately, that seems to have shifted. He hasn't been talking about this issue, and most distressingly, of course, he's added Sarah Palin to his ticket, who appears not even to believe that global warming is real. Happily, there's been more talk, at least more talk, from the Democratic side. Barack Obama adopted the demand of people across the country and or demonstrations last year. We organized 1,400 demonstrations across the country at Step It Up for 80% cuts in carbon emissions by 2050. The real question is, will he or McCain or anybody resume American leadership on this issue in the international forum? We have to take not only actions to cut our own carbon emissions, but to bring the rest of the world under control. And that's going to be the key question. The world's leaders are meeting in Poland in December of this year for a big meeting that's 1 year ahead of the final international climate conference set for Copenhagen in December of 2009. We've launched a drive at our website, 350.org, 350.org, to get people to send emails to both McCain and Obama asking them, please, to come if they're elected to that meeting in Poland and to demonstrate that America is going to get back in the game, that we're going to play some role in the future, as we have not for the last 8 years, in the international effort to control carbon dioxide. This will be a real signal to the rest of the world, if they decide to come, that we're going to resume America's traditional role of leadership in dealing with environmental questions, that we're serious about trying to cut some kind of deal with the Chinese and the Indians, that there's some possibility for real progress. That, I think, will be the best tell that we're going to get about whether or not either one of them is really deeply serious about dealing with global warming before it's too late.
I take it that you mean Obama has endorsed the goal of 80% carbon reduction by 2050, but he's promoted so-called clean coal as one of the solutions.
I'm not telling you in any way that anybody's perfect on this issue. Neither of these guys, and in fact, essentially virtually no one in the U.S. Senate or almost any place else in the halls of power. We've got lots of work to do to build a movement to hold them accountable, to try to make them do the things that they need doing, because you're right, the vested interest behind the coal and the ethanol and the nuclear and all the other industries are going to be on them all the time to do expensive and slow things that won't produce the kind of rapid change that we need. That's why I've spent the last couple of years trying to build a movement first around this country and now around the world at 350.org, that 350 number, referring to what the scientists now tell us is the most carbon measured in parts per million that we can safely have in the atmosphere.
And what are we up to now?
Unfortunately, we're over. We're at 387. We're just like the guy who went to the doctor and the doctor said, your cholesterol is too high. You're in that zone where you're going to have that heart attack or that stroke. You've got to bring it down. We've got to bring it down. It means emergency action around the world. It means not only not opening new coal-fired power plants, but closing down many of the ones we already have operating. It is a tough order and a tough job. And I don't know whether it'll happen or not. I mean, if you were a betting person, you might be wise to bet against it. On the other hand, we have no choice but to hope that in the few years we have to make this kind of change, we're able to build the movement that can demand it.
Bill McKibben, besides the emails you hope people will send to the two candidates, are there other grassroots efforts going on now that you think are worthwhile?
In this country, there's a strong effort being made by a group called OneSky.org, numeral1sky.org, and they're working hard to continue the work that we did with Step It Up to really press Congress for more cuts in domestic emissions. So there's that work going on in the U.S., and in this sort of global movement, 350.org is where the action is.
That was climate activist and author Bill McKibben. For more information on the movement to slow climate change, visit the websites 350.org or onesky.org. author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind's newest book, The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, examines how President Bush's policy decisions have affected the reputation and safety of the United States and the lives of millions in the U.S. and around the globe in the post-9/11 era. Suskind states that 3 months before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, U.S. and British intelligence agencies had received credible information from Saddam Hussein's intelligence chief, Tahir Habush, that the Iraqi military did not possess any weapons of mass destruction, President Bush's prime justification for the war. In one of the most publicized revelations in the book, Suskind charges that the White House instructed the CIA to forge a letter from Habush stating that the 9/11 hijacker, Mohammed Atta, had trained in Iraq for his mission in the U.S., and that Saddam Hussein had received uranium from the African nation of Niger with the help of al-Qaeda. Although some of Suskind's sources later denied corroborating this story, the author has presented transcripts of the original interviews and stands by the book's claims. Suskind asserts that President Bush's use of the CIA to deceive the American people on the justification for the Iraq War is an impeachable offense. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ron Suskind about the Bush administration deceptions detailed in his book and how the nation can hold these officials accountable for their violations of the public trust without impeachment proceedings.
And then in the fall of 2003, after that bad summer with Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame and all of the hubbub, where it becomes clear to everyone that the White House may have taken America to war under false pretenses, there's great panic in the executive branch. The president, the vice president, and a plan is hatched to use Habush to create a letter, a handwritten letter, 2 months before 9/11, ostensibly from Habush to Saddam, talking about Mohammed Atta training in Iraq before the 9/11 attacks, this backdated, fabricated letter, and also that Saddam's out buying uranium from Niger, just for good measure, all in the letter. It's a fabrication. It does pop up. As ordered, in December of 2003, slips into the bloodstream of the global news cycle, and ends up all over the world. Tom Brokaw talks about it on Meet the Press. William Sapphire writes a column about it. Of course, CNN, O'Reilly, you know, beats it for 5 days straight. That's illegal. It's illegal to run a disinformation campaign on the American public using an intelligence service. It's against U.S. law. And so that's why there's now two investigations, one in the House, one in the Senate, that are plodding along trying to gather evidence, albeit it's not easy to do. There's resistance inside of the administration. Remember, with that Joe Wilson-Valerie Plame thing, they needed to call in a special prosecutor. But, you know, ultimately I think it will be the bookending, this particular tale of Habush for the Bush administration, by virtue of how they compromise so many American principles, some of it born of really a lack of clarity about the fact that America's power in the world is really about being true to its oaths, transparency, justice, rule of law, a notion of accountability of the duly elected to the governed, all of those things that really the world prizes that we essentially compromise, often with very little effect, very little value, if you will, whether it's that or torture, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib. The book is so much about what we do now. How do we go about the process of repairing our moral authority, recovering moral energy? In this period of a global hearts and minds struggle, being true to one's oath, showing clearly to the vast, I call them non-voting constituencies around the world in many, many countries, what the United States actually represents, not just by word but by deed, is really the key to not only our success in the coming century, but really our safety.
I went to the CIA website, you know, to get the reaction to your story, as many other people have seen. They labeled it offensive and misleading, and of course all these denials that you mentioned a moment ago.
All to be expected.
All to be expected from this spook agency.
They're actually, it's interesting, Scott, they are, if they feel people's lives are at risk, and there was talk before this book came out, I had discussions with various of several of the sources about the safety of Habush. Once the book comes out, if there's a sense that Habush could be killed or this is compromising an ongoing top secret threat of intelligence. The practice is for the CIA to you know, mislead.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you, I mean, despite the best efforts of people like Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich and Washington Representative Jim McDermott, there won't be any impeachment proceedings before President Bush and Dick Cheney leave office. And my question to you is, given the smoking guns that you have found here, are there alternate methods for accountability here that will repair the damage that you talk about in your book that needs to be acknowledged? Many people in this country want accountability, and they want a clean house and make sure this doesn't happen again with another future president because of the precedent set here. What do you envision happening if there really is no accountability while Mr. Bush, Mr. Cheney are in office? Anything possible when they leave?
Yeah, well, there is some. Actually, Joe Biden, in a speech a few weeks ago, I think, maybe made sort of a veiled reference to some of these issues, where he talked about the fact that if he and Barack Obama take office in January, they will move forward in all these investigations. There are some precedents for presidents being investigated after they leave office. There's some sort of legal framework for that, at least. The key to restoring America's moral position in the world is, in fact, a kind of openness, the sort of hard facts of let's get it out on the table and let's act accordingly. A bit of truth and even reconciliation and reparation. That's how countries restore moral authority. It's frankly not that different for the lives of individuals or that of a nation. You know, it's about admitting what went wrong. It's about taking responsibility for it. It's about saying, here's the lessons learned that will not be repeated for everyone to see. And now here we move forward, based on that, to a kind of a brighter future.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind, author of The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism. Read transcripts of interviews from the book at ronsuskind.com/The Way of the World. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Toth. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.